So good afternoon, and welcome to the 488th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. Since its founding more than 40 years ago, the forum has been meeting monthly to hear from an invited speaker on a topic central to U.S. foreign policy. At today's meeting, we're pleased to have Dr. Jane Lute speaking on securing the homeland since 9/11. What have we learned? Jane Lute currently serves as a director of the Union Pacific Railroad, Marsh McLennan, and Shell PLC. Dr. Lute served as Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security from 2009 to 2013. She also served as Special Advisor to the Secretary General of the United Nations, where she held senior positions in peacekeeping, peacebuilding, and political affairs. She served as Chief Executive Officer of the Center for Internet Security, a not-for-profit organization providing cybersecurity services for state, local, tribal, and territorial governments. Dr. Lute is also Strategic Director for SICPA North America, a company that protects the integrity and value of products, processes, and documents, including most of the world's banknotes. I guess they, when I looked up this company, they do inks for banknotes to make sure that they're secure. It's interesting. She began her distinguished career in the United States Army, serving in Europe and Desert Storm, as well as on the National Security Council staff under both Presidents George H.W. Bush and William Clinton. Dr. Lute holds a doctorate in political science from Stanford University and a law degree from Georgetown University. What a distinguished and varied career she's had to date, and she's still very active, of course. Jane, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Thank you. Thank you. So I'm just going to make one correction, but not before I thank George and Karen, and especially Courtney, by the way, whose photos last night of the Northern Lights are killer, for their hospitality and welcoming me here. The one correction I am going to make is, please don't turn off your cell phone. I was a single mom for a very long time, and I am not going to be the reason your kids or your partner cannot reach you. Thank you for this. This is one of the most special opportunities that I ever get, which is talking to people who are outside the Washington bubble or the New York bubble, and really learning how you are thinking about the issues that have been preoccupying my friends and I, my colleagues and I, for most of our professional careers. And this is titled, What Have We Learned About Homeland Security Since 9/11? But really, I'd hope what you'll do with me is have this be a conversation about how to think about homeland security and what we want it to be or do in our lives. And that really requires that we think about the role of government in our lives. Now, I don't know a single American in the United States of America that interacts with government unless we have to. With one exception, voting. We don't have to vote, and we do. And that's interacting, but none of the rest of us at any other time interact with government unless we have to. So we don't often think about what role should government play in our lives, and how should it play its role through this thing we call the Department of Homeland Security, or through this thing we call Homeland Security. I'll tell you the three big lessons to me upfront that I've learned over the past, I don't know, almost 20 years, maybe a little less, in thinking about homeland security. And those lessons are T, IT, and GT. T, terrorism. There are people waking up every single day thinking about how to kill Americans. We're not unique in that regard. They have other targets around the world as well. But there are people, terrorists, who wake up every single day thinking about how to do that. IT, Over the course of the last 20 years, and intensively over the last 6 years, we have become so dependent on information technology and access to the internet. There is no enterprise in the US economy today that delivers value without relying on IT and access to the internet. And third, GT, global transition. We are now well into a 20-year period of global change. The global ordering is changing, and homeland security saw it coming first. So as I talk about these three big topics and how homeland security has informed at least my thinking, it's also informed how to my thinking about how to think about government in my life. What do I want it to do? And all of these changes that we're seeing today, whether it's IT or the global transformation of the transformation of the global order, is happening against a backdrop of four very powerful social norms that I think have infused the American public, and not only the American public, the global public. And those norms are inclusivity, transparency, reciprocity, and accountability. What do I mean? Inclusivity, nothing about me without me. We want to be included in every decision that affects our lives. Transparency, that doesn't mean that everybody gets to know everything all the time about everything that's going on, although most of us mean that when we say transparency. What we mean is, I want to know what's going on and how decisions are made. Reciprocity. We have very strong feelings about equal treatment. If I'm not allowed to do it, why is anybody else allowed to do it? If I'm compelled to do this, why isn't everybody compelled to do this? There's a very strong norm of reciprocity now running through the American social discourse, expectations of reciprocity. And finally, accountability. What do I mean? That means who will answer? We want to know who will answer for what's happening or what's not happening. And people are really asking, or informed by these deeply held norms that have emerged in a very powerful way to condition governments. And by and large, what we can tell you, and again, Homeland Security saw this coming, I think, before everyone else, is that publics everywhere are angry. They're angry. But this is a very particular kind of anger. This is not purpose-driven anger. I've seen purpose-driven anger. People kill each other in large numbers with purpose-driven anger. This is anxiety-based anger. We're uncertain. We're anxious about what's happening. So when you think about Homeland Security, think about what do you expect from your government? I have an answer for that for me. But I'm not sure that we, as a country, as a society, have really nailed down our expectations when it comes to government. Why isn't the government doing something? Really? Should the government be doing that? Is it the highest and best use of our public dollars, which are in all cases political dollars? Public dollars are political dollars. So we really need to ask ourselves these questions. But Homeland Security came into being after 9/11. I was in New York City that day. My husband worked at the Pentagon, was actually traveling with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And if any of you were in New York around 5 o'clock in the evening, jets flew over the middle of Manhattan. My husband was in one of those planes. I was stuck at the on-ramp of the Queensboro Bridge. And our daughter's school bus drove past the Pentagon, 20 minutes before the planes hit. So it was a very, very affecting experience for us, I think, as for all of us who remember this. But we talked about the evolution of this country since 9/11 as if that were the only thing that conditioned how we are behaving as a country, and it's certainly not. I think social anger, I think the collapse of trust in public institutions. We don't trust businesses, we don't trust banks, we don't trust the media, we don't trust markets. We are grasping around about for how to reconstruct trust in our social lives. And are we focusing on the right things? So what do we want our politics to reflect, and how does Homeland Security fit into that equation? Well, why do we pay for this department? I mean, I can tell you, when I was at DHS and writing the first ever comprehensive statement on Homeland Security, it was called the Quadrennial Homeland Security Review, not poetry. And really, it was the initial take on why is the country paying for this department? And what we wrote at the time was, the purpose of Homeland Security is to help create a safe, secure, resilient place where the American way of life can thrive. Okay, also not poetry, I get it. But it tells you how we were conceiving of this department. And the department had five core missions. Number one, prevent another 9/11. Number two, enforce our border security. Number three, administer and enforce our immigration laws. Number four, build national resilience in the face of disasters. And number five, ensure the cybersecurity of the nation's critical infrastructure. I'm going to spend a little time on cybersecurity as I go through this. And we did this in an environment where, frankly, if you take a step back and look at it, governments have lost the corner on the market on the three things that really used to define their essence: the control of lethality, the control of capital, and the control of rulemaking. That was already beginning to change at the time of 9/11. And we could see it dramatically change over the course of the past 25 years. But as I came into this, I came to Homeland Security from a background in national security and international security. I'd gone into the Army. I spent a career in the Army. The Army sent me to Stanford for my PhD. I wrote about how wars end, why they end when they do, why they don't end sooner. I ended up working on a project of how to prevent violent conflict. I became a peacekeeper. So I had spent my entire career in and around war and why we seem to love it, and how it could be prevented, what are the right ways to fight a war, how you can end them, and how you keep the peace once that peace has been achieved. So I thought I knew Homeland Security. Well, I was flat wrong. Homeland Security is massively different in important ways from national security. It's a component of national security, to be sure, but it's massively different. National security is strategic, it's centralized, and it's top-driven. It's dominated by a military, foreign policy, and intelligence culture. Many of you in this room know what I'm talking about. Washington is the national command authority. Well, Homeland Security is transactional. It's decentralized, and it's bottom-driven. It's driven by the localities, the cities, and the states in this country. It's dominated by a domestic political culture, an emergency response culture, a law enforcement culture. These are very different cultures. This is a very different approach to security. The relationship between the public, their government, and fear is very different. In national security, we believe the nation has to be attacked before we go to war. Okay, I'm with you. But that's the theory. In Homeland Security, if you're fearful that you or your neighbors are vulnerable to theft, to attacks, the mayor is fired. The chief of police is fired. So fear is much more proximate and manifests in very different ways in a homeland environment than in a national security or international security environment. I mean, it manifests, again, the differences in so many ways. Information, again, is shared in national security on a need-to-know basis. In homeland security, there's a duty to share. There's a duty to share. What did you know, and when did you know it? And Washington is not the national command authority. It's the federal partner. And it's not unity of command. I don't know a single fire chief that thinks the police chief is the boss of him or her. You are not the boss of me. I mean, that's just not how they operate. It's unity of effort. So it's a very different orientation. So what do we want when we say prevent another 9/11? How many of you have flown on an airplane in the past month? Were you worried about the plane being blown up? You probably were not. Okay? It wasn't just good luck or great timing on your part. Okay? There has been an accumulation of effort to ensure that the safety of the traveling public, particularly in the air. Now, I don't know anyone who just like is really anxious to run through a TSA line, although I got to tell you, these guys are really pretty good and gals are really pretty good now. We have all kinds of options for streamlining your experience. Why? Because from the early days, we weren't just trying to focus on who do we need to worry about. We wanted to focus on who are the people we don't have to worry about. And all of the pre-check, the clear, the other expedited means of traveling through the airports now mean we don't have to worry about you. And that took longer, was more frustrating for most of us, and most of us didn't understand that that's what was going on. We weren't trying to rule in the bad guys. Yeah, certainly we were. But it turns out it's a relatively more straightforward exercise than saying, who can we put aside that we don't have to worry about because there's way more of you than there are of them. So, and it's proven to be a much more sticky and successful process. Yes, are we still looking at bad guys? Of course we are. Are they out there? Like I said, they're out there. Controlling the borders. I talked a little bit about this, you know, as one of the five missions. There's tension in this mission. And this is something I think people also don't really appreciate about Homeland Security. There is tension in these missions. You know, when you think about the mission of the Department of Defense, it's one and done. Fight and win the nation's wars. Okay, there's, you know, a lot of commentary underneath it. I get that. But in Homeland Security, if you just think about securing our borders, there's tension. On the one hand, we want to keep out people and things that might be dangerous. But on the other hand, we want to welcome those who enrich our we want to expedite legitimate trade and travel. Keep out things and people who are dangerous, expedite legitimate trade and travel. These are in tension with each other, especially when you're talking about speed and volume of your transaction or any transaction at the border. When it comes to immigration, similarly, there's tension in this mission. Right? On the one hand, we want to welcome people who enrich our culture and our economy. We want to welcome them. I'm the grandchild of immigrants. I think they were legal. We couldn't find them when we went looking at Ellis Island, but I'm here. And on the other hand, we want to keep out people who might be dangerous. There's tension in these missions. You know, we want to be prepared for natural disasters. There's been a huge debate over the years in the national disaster community about do we do mitigation or do we acknowledge that we're going to have these things, we can't prevent them, and we need to build resilience in the face of these events when they happen, and they're happening more and more frequently, involving more and more people. So if we're building national resilience, we want to prevent bad things from happening, but we also want to respond rapidly and effectively when they do. This is one of the reasons that people love the Coast Guard, right? 90% of the American population lives within 1 hour of a major body of water. And if you're in trouble on that body of water, as this community well knows, you want the Coast Guard there within that golden hour. And then finally, cybersecurity. We want to ensure the cybersecurity of the nation's critical infrastructure. I want to spend a minute on that. Because it really is true that our reliance on IT and access to the internet has been complete. But get ready, AI is changing absolutely everything. There's no activity, organization, or enterprise that will not be affected by AI. Your devices, your phones, your watch, believe it or not, your toilet is talking about you. They're all talking about you. I mean, it's really annoying, right? I mean, one of the things that frustrates me about this, if you're I'm shopping for brown shoes. I'm looking around, I finally find a pair of shoes, I buy the brown shoes. What do I get? I get inundated with advertisements for brown shoes. Hey, if you're so smart, how come you don't know I bought the shoes? But it's everywhere, and it's really impossible to overstate the positive effects of AI. But surely, we're vulnerable to the dangers that it presents. I think threats to our privacy are at the top of everyone's list. And if you haven't yet experienced your phone eavesdropping on you, you're in for a surprise. You could just go walking. This happened to me today. I went walking on the street, the main street in Camden, and then I got advertisements from a couple of the shops. Like, okay. My kids don't even know I'm here. Some threats that we're facing are real and close. Identity compromise, financial theft, cheating of all kinds, and even the physical destruction of property. And few of us really understand how we should think about this or what role we want government to play in keeping us safe. And this is a really interesting question for Homeland Security because security is typically an assignment that's given to governments. We want safe streets. Governments, you run the police. You make the laws. You raise an army. So this is an assignment we give to governments, typically, security. But we have not given this assignment to government when it comes to cyber security. In part because I think we instinctively know that government doesn't have the power that matters here. In cyberspace, it's the power to connect us that we value much more than the power to protect us. And so we need to think about what role we want to have government play when it comes to cybersecurity. Of course, nothing of all I've described is happening in a vacuum. We've entered a 20-year period of global reordering, and we feel dangerously close to a level of animosity and conflict on a global scale from which we or any of the other societies around the world will not easily rebound. Today, it seems that everything is just moving too fast along too broad a front, involving too many actors with too many grievances, with too little solutions, and whoa, too little trust. So we have not really, I think, appreciated what the internet has brought us. It has brought us the power to de-miniaturize ourselves. We're no longer put in that box that our parents or our friends or our siblings put us in when we were little. We can be whoever it is we want to be. And I've had the pleasure of meeting a number of you, not all, but I can tell you the least interesting thing about any of us is whether we're a Democrat or a Republican. It's kind of the least interesting thing. We play a game sometimes when my husband and I, when we're out in groups that we meet is, as we're meeting people, tell the table something about yourself that no one here knows. You gotta have nerves of steel when you ask that question, by the way. But as we're entering this world, not only our immediate world, where we are able to de-miniaturize ourselves, I don't have to just be the Jewish mother of four who's in her 60s. I can be whoever it is I want to be. What are we doing with this power? We are re-miniaturizing ourselves. We're going back into the boxes and back into the silos that this extraordinary capability has allowed us to escape from. And so we now need to think more clearly and honestly, whether you are a Republican or Democrat, whether you're a conservative, liberal, whatever your religion is, whatever birth order you're in. And youngest child, I have issues with you, okay? I'm a middle child of seven. But we really have to confront all of the anxiety that we feel that's making us angry. And we really need to understand how we can come together. The merging of cyberspace and physical space has meant that nothing happens in cyberspace. No malicious act or malintentioned act or mischief is designed to stay in cyberspace. It's designed to have a physical world effect. What do you want your government to do about that? So security, as I said, is an inherently governmental function. And governments provide for their nation's security by three ways, right? Regulating, spending, and providing key services such as police, law enforcement, intelligence, and military operations. But we are at an inflection point in this country, as we all know. We're living in a world where the population has never been higher, but the global population and the national population has never in its history been wealthier, more educated, more politically engaged than ever before. So, yes, people are feeling empowered, but they also feel powerless in the face of what their government can mean or do for them. In my life, there have been four strategic eras that have characterized U.S. policymaking, both in defense and in homeland security. At the end of World War II, we went into the post-war period, and the big strategic question in that era was, how do we prevent World War III? With the Cuban Missile Crisis, the second strategic era came, and the real question was, how do we prevent nuclear annihilation of the planet when the only thing standing between us and the precipice is our judgment? At the end of the Cold War, it was really clear the United States was that much more powerful than anyone else. And though the big strategic question was, what will we do with this power? Many believe that with the invasion of Iraq in 2003, the president answered that question by saying, whatever we think we need to do, we will do. And the question became, how firm, how fragile, perhaps, is the American commitment to liberal democracy? Well, that answer comes down to what we think and what we want our government to be and do. Through each of these eras, we have been together because we have never lost faith in ourselves or in each other. When I was in peacekeeping, people used to ask me, man, you have military people and civilian people in the same, you know, operation. How does that work? I said, you know, soldiers go to these places expecting the worst humanity has to offer. Civilians go to these places believing in the best humanity has to offer. It's a powerful combination. And I will say the same thing to us. Conservatives approach the world expecting the worst. And liberals approach the world believing in the best. And together, it should remind us that this country has always been great. Thank you very much.
I like your optimism. A lot of speakers we have are not quite as optimistic.
I'm very optimistic.
And it's really nice. You said at the very beginning that, you know, you asked the question, what do you think the role of government should be? And you said you have your own views. Are you willing to share some
sure.
of your own views with us on what you think the role of government should be?
I think The government should deliver threshold conditions for security, well-being, and justice. Period.
Which is probably easier said than done. It's easier said than done.
You know, I accept that. But ask yourself now, where are we turning for security? Where are we turning for well-being? And what is security anyway? Security is freedom from fear of attack, but it is also the responsible exercise of power. What is well-being? Well-being is access to economic opportunity, but it's also a safety net for the most vulnerable among us. And what is justice? There is no fundamental justice without a say in how you're governed. So, I mean, I can unpack this, but I know we're on the clock.
Someone wanted to ask about how we should think about the use of national security forces and the support of DHS functions. You were making a distinction between national security and the way that operates and the way Homeland Security does. So what should be the role, if any?
So if we think about terrorism, I mean, what we talked about this last night, what's your theory of the case, right? That the bad guys are out there trying to come here. That's the basic theory of the case when it comes to global terrorism, international terrorism. So what do we need to do about it? We need to find them where they are, keep them where they are, far away from us. What do we have to do that? We have our intelligence capability, we have the military, and we have our allies. Question, what if they're already here? What's your theory of the case? And how useful domestically is our intelligence community? The answer, it shouldn't be at all useful in the same sense that it is useful abroad. Of course it is. It has important pathologies, I think, that limit its utility in homeland security. How useful is our military domestically? Are we comfortable with the military being deployed on every street corner? We're not, basically, we're not. Even if you agree that crime in certain places is at unacceptable levels. These are law enforcement matters. These are not military matters to most of us. You know, and then finally, the Brits or the French, you know, so you need a different approach. It has uses, but it also has limitations.
There is a question about how the DHS has evolved. The 9/11 Commission found that the agency's failure to share information was crucial to the attack's success. Has that factor eased in the last 20 years? And if so, how does that square with the need to know?
Yeah, it's better, it's not 100% better. I mean, I talked about intelligence pathologies. There are two that, you know, I was reminded of again and again, with apologies to my colleagues here from the intelligence community. You know I love you, but intelligence pathology number one, the harder a piece of information is to get, the more valuable it must be. And so we have all these highly technical systems that are deployed for tens of millions of dollars, arrayed around the world. And a hot dog vendor in Times Square was the one who identified the Times Square bomber. Right. What's the second pathology? The higher a source of information, the more valuable it must be. Now, I'm willing to talk to Vladimir Putin's driver. I don't need to talk to him. I can learn a lot. So again, there are limitations. We are better at sharing. We're not great because bureaucratic rivalries are alive and well. And in nowhere was this more obvious than in the area of cybersecurity.
And someone wants to know whether it's your view that it was worthwhile, that we should have, created DHS to replace to coordinate the individual agencies like the FBI, the DNI. I mean, was that a good move? Did we need to do that?
I don't know anybody from the FBI or DNI who would say DHS coordinates us.
The
White House has emerged as, you know, the singular source of direction, not only where we're going, but the cadence, the rate of march. And by the way, as a policymaker, if you don't understand the difference between direction and pace, you're going to do a lot of damage. And it's true for the international community as well. We get the direction on a lot of these problems right. We get the pace wrong almost always, for much more complicated reasons. I think the department has value. It is the federal partner to state and local governments. And so what do we turn to the federal government for? You know, do we turn to it for funding, we turn to it for regulating, we turn to it from time to time for operating capabilities. And so this partnership, I think, you know, it's most powerful and effective when the federal government, when you see the federal government working with states and localities on helping to solve problems. It's about as effective as every other federal agency when it comes to bossing each other around.
That's a very general question. Can the U.S. create a secure homeland without exercising leadership on the world stage?
So that to me is the question. This is the strategic era we've entered, this 20-year period of global reordering. Will it happen in relative peace without U.S. leadership? No, I think this country needs four things at this moment in its history for you know, and maybe it's a little tautological, I apologize for that. The first thing is we need a safe and secure homeland. We need Americans to feel safe, secure, with a sense of resilience. People talk about soft power. The late Joe Nye was a huge colleague, friend, and hero of mine. I'm kind of done talking about soft power, though, with apologies to Joe, who recently passed away. I'm tired of talking about hard power. I spent a career in the Army. Okay, great. I'm really interested in America's deep power. We have a deep power that we're only, I think, slowly beginning to realize. So what do we need? We need a safe and secure homeland. We need a dynamic economic engine that can generate new wealth. That's a high bar. You know, we need strong friends and allies to me, and we need predictable relations with others. That's about the rule of law. So I think these things hang together.
And then could you elaborate on your point that we are re-miniaturizing ourselves? And what do we do about it? I didn't understand myself what you meant by re-miniaturizing.
We're going back into these boxes. You know, whether it's Republican or Democrat. I mean, that's the least interesting thing about us. If you're Jewish, you feel like you're being forced into a box again. And it's a dangerous box, frankly, if you ask any of us. So that's what I mean. We have this enormous capability to learn, to grow, to affiliate, to be or do, and to find meaning. And let's face it, meaning is more important than belonging. Belonging is more important than doing, and doing is more important than being. So I don't like being shoved back into a box because of the power that someone's wielding on the internet.
But do you see a way to us to reverse this trend?
I think each of us have the power in our hands. We know what to do in this environment if we don't like what's happening politically. And if we don't like what's happening online, we know what to do. I mean, the market's a wonderful mechanism. Okay, except when it's not. Right? And a lot of us don't feel like it's worth it. Is this where you place your trust? It might be where you have your money, but is the market where you have your trust? How fragile is that?
And there's a question about the abuses of social media. Do you see a role for DHS in preventing the kind of abuse that social media can force upon us and our children?
You won't like my answer. I'm not sure I do. I mean, when I was in government, we were asked this question about domestic extremism and the role of DHS. And I thought hard and long, because people had us doing you know, as we were sort of trying to develop policy here, people were putting all kinds of ideas on the table, and frankly, it didn't make me comfortable. And I came down with two things where the federal government in partnership with state and locals can play a role for these kinds of things. And those two things were to break down barriers that isolate communities and draw a line against violent behavior. Draw very clear, decisive lines against violent behavior. Now, some people, many people said that doesn't go far enough. We need our government to do more. What do you want your government to do? Not just be. And so when it comes to, you know, cracking down on social media, there was a big dust up under the Biden administration about countering mis and disinformation. People didn't like that very much because one person's disinformation was another person's affirmation. Can we get back to ground truth? And do we expect our government to be the source of that truth? Yes, at some level we do. As I've said before, governments have lost the corner on the market, on the control of legality, the control of capital, and the control of rulemaking. And that loss is also underwritten by a loss of authority. We don't have any consensus around who adjudicates truth. We ought to get past that.
You know, there's another aspect of this. Our second district congressman from Maine, Jared Golden, just announced he's not going to rerun for Congress. And one thing he cited was the number of threats to him, to his family, et cetera, that he was getting primarily through the internet. Is there anything we can do about these type of things?
It's very real. I mean, they show up at your house. They put your kids' pictures online. They publish when your kid leaves the house. They take videos of your family. You may be willing to put up with this, but I guarantee you your family didn't sign on for it. It's real. And are we going to put up with this? Why are we putting up with this?
I'm back to what we can do about it. Someone wants to know whether our representatives in Congress and the senators understand the Homeland Security mission, or do they understand the way you do, and have they helped or undercut the department's efforts?
You know, everybody, sort of what I've laid out for you, Courtney asked me, you know, you have an article to share. I really didn't. Actually, I had one article I was going to share on immigration, but Blas is coming in a couple of weeks. And it was an article by him. I mean, he's a very thoughtful, smart, committed public servant, and you should ask him all your immigration. You should ask him all your immigration questions. I used to tell people that, you know, we had 535 members of our board at Homeland Security. We had 107 committees and subcommittees in Congress that we reported to, because every member of Congress, I know, you know, I think DOD has four, whatever. But every member of Congress considers themselves an expert on Homeland Security, because they are. Because they interact with you all. Certainly members of the House have to get, you know, reelected every couple of years. And, you know, you're facing now, I think, an important election in the Senate. So you will interact with your representatives. This is Maine, after all. What am I telling you guys? So, yeah, this is kind of a funny story. When I got to the Department of Homeland Security in 2009, the department was unauditable. I said, I'm sorry, what does that mean? It means we don't know where the money's going? Yeah, that's not okay. So first order of business, you know, when you're the number two, you know, you're the chief operating officer of the department. What does chief operating officer do? You don't run anything, but you see that everything is running. We need a clean audit opinion. And it took us 4 years, but Congress was so supportive every step along the way, and it still has a clean audit opinion, and DOD is still unauditable.
And here's a more general question. Combining your experience in the Army with cyber and security, Homeland Security, how secure do you think our military's cyber is? And how dependent are they on cyber?
Everyone is absolutely dependent on cyber. We have the best military in the world. Absolutely. And it has the best technology, the best capability, the best young men and women. It has two secret weapons that people don't appreciate. Secret weapon number one is the NCO Corps. It is a secret weapon of the United States military. Other militaries come pretty close. The Brits come pretty close. The French come pretty close. Nobody else comes as close. No one is, I think, in my view, as good as we are in our NCO Corps. And the second thing we have is the ability to sustain a fight anywhere in the world. We can get anywhere in the world, apparently from Missouri. And we can sustain any fight longer than anyone else. How good is our cyber? Let me answer that question in the following way. So when I was at Homeland Security, we had a knockdown, drag-out fight with the National Security Agency over who ought to run cybersecurity on behalf of the federal government domestically in the United States. And one of my colleagues, military member, said, I need to be in every single network in order to defend it. And I said, over my dead body. We're not going to have a military presence in every single network in this country. Cyberspace is civilian space. But if you think about the .mil, the .ic world, how big is that? Let's say it's the size of this, by the way, non-functioning clock that I was looking at when I was talking. Okay. That's .mil. How big is .gov compared to .mil? Let's say it's the size of that table. And how big is .com, and now in the IPv6 world, compared to that table? Maybe this room, maybe the building, maybe this compound. So if the military is protecting its own space, all well and good. But it cannot protect all the space that needs protecting.
You talked about how anxious people are. And someone wants to know, why we're so anxious, and I think maybe you've answered a lot of that. But is there then one thing you can think of that would actually help us all kind of sleep at night?
You know, I got asked that question last night, what keeps you up at night? And there's only one thing, that we will lose faith in each other. That's the only thing that keeps me up. And so, it's us. Look to your right and look to your left. We are the help. We are the help we're waiting for.
And there's a lot of questions about the current situation. How are the current DHS cuts going to affect Homeland Security, and how can we prepare for and stay aware of the coming threats? Two separate questions, but...
Yeah. I'm not in government anymore. The DHS budget has grown threefold relatively recently, with a big focus on immigration, which is what the president said he was going to do. How do we learn about the threats? How do we anticipate the threats? What do we do about the threats? I mean, you know, there's four or five things you can do in cyberspace. Every enterprise ought to be doing them, you know? I know people focus on threats. The intelligence community focuses on threats. I focus on what we do about threats. Like when I would send my kids out to school in the morning, I wouldn't read them the police blotter report. I'd say, you know, don't talk to strangers. If you see something, say something, right? I don't brief my daughter on meningococcal this or meningococcal that. I said, wash your hands, don't share brushes. You know, I mean, I'm more interested in, you know, there are some obvious things that we know are dangerous and potentially threatening. And are we doing those basic things? Are we talking to each other? Are we helping our neighbors out? You know, are we checking what's connected to our Wi-Fi networks? You know, do we know what we're running on these phones? None of us have any idea anymore. So, you know, threats are one thing. I'll leave that to the experts. I'm more interested in that accumulation of things we can do to be safer.
And someone wants to know, are we compromising Homeland Security due to the singular obsession with ICE deportations? Are we neglecting things that we should be putting more effort into?
Look, there's no question that this administration is focused on immigration. But those other missions are not going anywhere. We need to continue to be vigilant to prevent another 9/11, to prevent another terrorist from attacking on our soils. You know, we need to enforce our border and immigration laws, build national resilience. We see this again and again and again. Los Angeles, you know, saw as much rain as Noah over the last 5 days. So it is a set of priorities that the president was very clear about. But the other missions of Homeland Security aren't going anywhere.
And how about the actual practices of ICE, the masking of agents, et cetera? Does that undercut this whole overall security environment by increasing the, you know, people's fear of government?
I think for many people who supported this agenda, ICE is doing what it needs to do to be able to discharge its missions. I think for many people who oppose this agenda, we're deeply uncomfortable looking at law enforcement officials that are wearing face masks or breaking into vehicles or going onto property without the lawful means, you know, permission or a warrant to do so. I think we're very conflicted about this, quite frankly. And, you know, does it affect how we view government? Does this make you afraid of your government? It's certainly making a number of Americans more afraid of their government than had ever before. Is this giving you confidence in your government? For some people, you know, this is what they wanted government to do. And we cannot claim that we didn't know that this was coming.
Do you really think we knew the actual tactics that we're using were coming?
I think we knew. The president was very clear. He was going to forcefully enforce the deportation of undocumented, illegal people in this country. He was very clear.
And then what do you say now to people of color, or of the idea that you can be dragged aside and whatever, just based on your apparent ethnicity and what neighborhood you might live in?
I'm certainly not going to defend these tactics. I'm not going to. But for those of us as communities, wherever we can and however we can, we know how to change a political direction when we don't like it.
We vote. And then how do we prevent such things as the expanded ICE forces from becoming President Trump's personal police force and subject to his whim? Or don't you believe that is likely to or possible to happen?
Yeah, I can't be helpful to you on this question.
Okay, fair enough. And someone wants to know how you keep your focus as you do when we have, they say, someone like Kristi Noem as head of Homeland Security. ICE Barbie.
So I'm gonna break that in half. How do I keep my focus? How do I maintain my faith in this country?
Yes.
Look at each other. Look at who we are. You know, I mean, English was not my mother's first language, of all things. She spoke Ukrainian. I mean, really? If you had told me when I was a kid that the Yukis would be at the center of global attention, I'm sorry, that's what we called ourselves. I would have said, are you kidding me? Most people don't know where the Ukraine is. Now everybody knows where it is. I mean, the world has dramatically changed, right? I mean, but you would never take me for anything other than central casting. Straight up, give me the American broad. Okay, here I am, right? My grandparents came to this country. When I was, the first time at the National Security Council staff at the White House, I got a note from my grandmother, God rest her soul. I don't have the note. I have the envelope that the note was in, where she practiced signing her name. I have that note. And here I stand. How can I not be optimistic about this country?
And I think we have time for maybe one more question here. In a high-tech world where we have synthetic biology, AI, ubiquitous air travel, all this, a terrorist anywhere can potentially let loose a pathogen or whatever. How do we really defend against that type of thing? Or is that where the being prepared, consequence management come in?
Yeah, I have a smart aleck answer to that question. Will surprise you. Look, deepfakes have been around. I mean, if you think about AI and the role of deepfakes, have been around since Jacob and Rebecca scammed Isaac, right? Been around a long time. But they've gotten really good, and they're really dangerous. And we need more protections, quite frankly. We need the major AI developers, and there's about six of them in the world that are in a race right now to dominate, who are at the frontier of AI development. And this is technology that's impossible, really, to keep out of the hands of anyone who wants it. It's like the bio threat. You know, on the one hand, you worry about someone like Vladimir Putin or another, Assad in Syria previously using chemical weapons or biological weapons, and we also worry about anybody using these weapons. It's certainly a dangerous time. And we're certainly feeling our way through this. You know, is AI going to change everything? Yeah, it will change. It will change everything. What's standing between us and the precipice? Our judgment. What will we do?
Thank you very much.